Exodus chapter 32, please, in your Bibles, Exodus chapter 32. We'll read about the golden calf incident in the first six verses, and then we'll go to the passage we're going to be looking at tonight. So Exodus 32, beginning with verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron, and received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Then you'll see in verses 7 through 10, the indignation of God. Verses 15 to 19, the indignation of Moses. Verses 11 to 14, the intercession of Moses. He stands in the gap. And then we see in verses 20 to 24, Moses' confrontation. Let's look at those verses. Verse 20. And he, referring to Moses, took the calf which they had made and burnt it in the fire and ground it to powder and strawed it upon the water and made the children of Israel drink of it. And Moses said unto Aaron, What did this people unto thee that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people that they are set on mischief. For they said unto me, Make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And I said unto them, Whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it me, then I cast it into the fire, and there came out this calf. So here's the confrontation. We've talked the last couple of weeks about what it takes to confront somebody. And the fact that we would rather talk about somebody rather than talk to the person. And we looked at Leviticus 19, verses 15 to 18, and we considered these three things, that if you're going to confront or rebuke somebody, as Moses does here, number one, consider yourself. Number two, consider your spirit. And number three, consider your recipient. Tonight, we see Moses' confrontation in these verses. 2 points I want to make about this tonight. Number one, Moses' confrontation with the people in verse 20. And then Moses' confrontation with the leader in 21 to 24. The fact is, he confronts. Worshiping this golden calf is at least three times in this chapter named as a great sin. But apparently the people didn't think it was that big of a deal. And neither did Aaron. Not until Moses confronted them about it. One of the reasons people today don't think their sin is great, think about this, is because they're not confronted about it. How many things, issues aren't confronted? In the family, all it takes is a sibling to confront the other sibling to get that sibling to think, you know, I did wrong. Parents are not confronting children. Go to any Walmart and you'll find out. What do those children? They need to be confronted. Sometimes people don't know that what they're doing is wrong because they're not confronted about it. In church, members sometimes do not confront their brothers and sisters. Leaders, deacons, pastor, don't confront by refusing membership to those who live in sin or perhaps practicing church discipline. More and more sin is being tolerated, not just in our churches, but obviously in our society. Or maybe I should say not only in our society, but also in our churches. The responses that are given in Exodus 32 show the seriousness of the sin: indignation, intercession, confrontation. And here's the confrontation we see tonight. Keeping your finger here in Exodus 32, please go to Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 21. As Moses is recounting what takes place here later on, as he is instructing the children of Israel right before they go into the land of promise. In Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 21, the Bible says this, Moses speaking, "And I took your sin, the calf which ye had made." So what does Moses call the calf? What does he call the calf? Sin. Your sin. He goes, "Your sin. I took your sin, the calf which ye had made, and burnt it with fire and stamped it and ground it very small, even until it was as small as dust. And I cast the dust thereof into the brook that descended out of the mount." So Moses calls the calf that they made your sin. Their sin was the idol they had fashioned with the approval of Aaron. They had created an idol. Folks, understand something. All idols are created. The real God, Jehovah, the I am who I am, the very words there say, he is not created. He is self-existent. Every idol is created. So every idol that you have, and Christians have idols too. It may not be that little thing that you put on a dashboard of your car, but you have idols. I have idols. Things that we have to constantly say, I can't. That's becoming too big of a thing in my life, and I've got to back off from that. Because this is replacing God. This is what happens with sports. This is what happens with jobs. This is what happens with all kinds of weekend type things that we want to do. They become our gods, little idols. Notice that Moses does not first go to Aaron in verse 20. Who does he confront first? Well, the outline is he confronts the people in verse 20, and then he confronts the leader in verses 21 to 24. So he goes to the people first. You would think he would go to the leader first and say, "What are you doing?" But he goes to the people first. And he doesn't go to Aaron like, "Hey, Aaron, am I missing something here? I mean, what are you doing?" As if Moses is kind of in doubt. Well, maybe I'm the one who's wrong here. Moses very clearly sees this is a great sin. God has already confronted Moses about it. Moses now confronts the people. I like what A.W. Pink said. He said, "Moses comes down in an energy that could take a stand single-handed against 600,000 men, because there are 600,000 men. Men that could execute judgment on their sin, you know, that Moses could execute judgment on their sin and maintain what was due to God. It is just the contrast between the servant who is with men and the servant who is with God." Aaron with men does not confront the people because he's been with men. Moses has been with God, and therefore he can confront men. And sometimes that's our problem. We're not with God enough, where we see the problem in people's lives, including our own, that needs to be confronted. So Aaron does not excuse the people just because Aaron, the leader, is complicit in their sin. He still does not excuse the people. And now he demonstrates to the people the vanity of what they were so foolishly worshiping. I mean, imagine this. They create this God. They create this golden calf. And then they fall down and worship it. How absurd. But the point is this: Christians have the same thing in their lives. We create idols by elevating in our lives things that soon begin to displace or compete with who God is. And we set those, we create those things. It may not be something, again, that is tangible that you can see, but it may be even an idea that we create. Four things that verse 20 states that Moses does with their sin. Because remember, the calf is called their sin. So let's just put these four things down. Moses burnt their sin. Moses ground their sin. Moses strawed their sin. Moses made the people drink their sin. Because the calf, according to Deuteronomy 9:21, is your sin. So first of all, Moses burned their sin, the calf, in the fire. The fire. What fire? Is it the fire of the altar, or is it possibly the kiln, the fire of the kiln that was used to fashion the golden calf, as you see in verse 24? He cast it into the fire out of which perhaps this calf came out. When you read about Aaron's words there, well, I threw this in and out came this calf. And we smile at that. I have something to say about that here in just a minute. The point I want you to get now is this. What one man created, Aaron, another man, Moses, can simply uncreate. Isn't it interesting that our idols can be uncreated? Our little gods can be destroyed? What kind of a God is it? If it lasts for mere moments. I mean, the ideas, the things that we think so much of. It's easy to make a vehicle an idol. And I know that. It really hurt. When I drove home after church about a year ago, and my truck got pummeled with hail. It really hurt. I'll just be very honest with you. You got a brand new vehicle that I've never had a brand new vehicle in my life. The first one I've ever had. And I'm in the truck and the windshield shatters right in front. It doesn't shatter, but you get this huge thing. And this is on the internet. I shouldn't tell you how fast I was going. When I was going down 4th Street, I think I was doing probably 60 or 70 miles an hour trying to get home. Probably made it worse. I don't know. And it made me think, you know what? This is just a thing. This is just a thing. And yet sometimes we take things and we elevate them to a godlike status and they compete. Moses simply uncreated it. Try doing that with the self-existent Yahweh. Try uncreating him. The destruction and the obliteration of this calf is a vivid illustration of the emptiness of idolatry, completely empty. It's like the commentator Davis said, if the calf could not save itself, are you seeing where I'm going here? If the calf couldn't save itself, it certainly could not save or even aid its worshipers. And the psalmist points out that absurdity in Psalm 115, verses 3 to 9. And Isaiah in chapter 46, verses 5 through 7. You go out into the forest and you chop this tree down. And with one third of it, you take it and you burn it into fire to warm yourself. With the other third, you burn it into fire to warm your oven so that you can eat something. With the other third, you cut it up into an idol, fall down and worship it. How absolutely stupid. And that's what we do. We can look at Aaron here and say, what an idiot. But folks, let's point at ourselves and say, sometimes we're quite the idiots when it comes to what we elevate to a godlike status. Moses burned their sin. Secondly, Moses ground their sin. The gold that was previously in the beautiful form of this calf is now reduced to something mere powder. It's been pulverized, unable to be retrieved, to be formed into anything again. And I think that's why he ground it to powder. Now you can no longer bring this thing back into existence. It's gone. And it's exactly what was to be done to the idols of the Canaanites, Exodus 23, verse 24. When you get into the land, you see their idols, you completely destroy them. That's what Moses is doing to their sin. Thirdly, Moses strawed their sin. Moses took what was previously in the form of a calf and scattered it upon the water. What water? This is the brook that descended out of the mount. So the water that came down miraculously from the mount, because this is when they were griping for water in Exodus chapter 17, and Moses struck the rock where he was supposed to strike it, and water came gushing out. That water is still flowing. And he takes this calf and he pulverizes it, throws it into that water. And then fourthly, Moses made the people drink their sin. What they once worshipped and credited for their deliverance, they now drink, mixed in the waters that God had miraculously provided out of the mount. When they had chided Moses and demanding water to drink. They're now made to drink their God. The emblematical action, Bush says, not only showed them how utterly contemptible was the idol, which could thus be reduced to so near nothing, but taught them in a most impressive manner that the backslider in heart shall always be filled with his own ways. Proverbs 14:14, the backslider in heart shall be filled with his own ways. I wonder if this isn't what we see in God visiting their sin upon them, because they're drinking pure water, but it's got this pulverized gold in it, and they're having to drink it. And I'm wondering if that doesn't kind of, if that's not emblematic of something else that takes place in the book of, in the first five books, where if somebody was caught in adultery and a woman was caught in adultery, she was made to drink a certain kind of water, and if it made her sick, she was guilty, and if not, she was not guilty. Because you read this in verse 34, therefore now go lead the people unto the place of which I had spoken unto thee. Behold, mine angel shall go before thee. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. And I wonder if this isn't what this is talking about. So Moses confronts the people. He burns their sin. He grinds their sin. He straws their sin. He makes the people drink their sin. He's confronted the people. Now, secondly, he confronts the leader. And the leader is his brother, his older brother, by 3 years, Aaron. Two things I want you to see here. Number one, the exasperation of Moses. He's exasperated, I think, in verse 21. Moses said unto Aaron, what did this people unto thee, that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? He states that Aaron brought this great sin upon them. In verse 35, the summary there clearly states that both the people and Aaron made the calf. Whatever the people did, Moses knows that Aaron is complicit in what they did. Could the people excuse themselves because their spiritual leader was complicit? No. But they would try. And the sheep many times try to get the shepherd to stretch his biblical standards, be pushy on worship styles, and then excuse themselves and say, well, this is shepherd approved. And if the leader will not be persuaded, because he's not there, he's up on the mount, if he can't be persuaded, go to the number two guy. Go to the assistant pastor. Go to the youth pastor. Go to a deacon. Go to the Bible study leader. Because there's always a Judas interested in making glad those who would crucify the chief shepherd or his under-shepherds. There's always somebody like that. This was a great sin, as you'll see repeated in verses 30 and 31. The involvement of Aaron was no small matter, as is indicated in Deuteronomy 9:20. We read 9:21. Look at Deuteronomy 9:20. Which says, and the Lord was very angry with Aaron to have destroyed him. And I prayed for Aaron also the same time. Moses had vested a lot of confidence in his brother Aaron. Before having gone up into the mount, you read about it in 24:14. Let's read about it again. 24:14. Moses said to the elders, tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, let him come unto them. If somebody's got a problem, go to Aaron. Go to Hur. Delegated authority was given to Aaron, to Hur. Responsibility. And Moses also had clearly instructed Aaron and the others as to where they were to wait for Moses. Do you see it there? Tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. If the people have a problem, they come to you. Don't go to them. And where do you find Aaron in Exodus 32? Is he still where Moses has said, stay here? This is an issue. Aaron had somehow migrated down the mountain, down from where he is, halfway up the mountain or whatever, down to where the people are at the base of the mountain. He is not where Moses had instructed him to stay. As Bush says, the truth is, if we mistake not, they were expressly required to abide in the spot where they had enjoyed the vision till Moses returned. To this spot, such of the people as had matters to do were permitted and directed to come as often as they had occasion for judicial decisions. Go to Aaron. Aaron does not come down to you. And Bush makes this application. And we think that the first step in Aaron's sin was his deserting his post and going down, contrary to Moses' direction, into the midst of the camp. He deserted his post. You know, it's difficult to find an assistant who knows his place. You know this in the employee, in the employer type business. If you're an employer, it's difficult to find an assistant who knows their place, who keeps his post, who doesn't think that he or she is so important that they can presume to make so-called executive decisions. Aaron is not the executive. So he should not have made decisions as if he was the executive. But that's what he does. And so now Moses is completely exasperated with him. And it's understandable when you recognize the fact that Aaron should have done with the people what Moses is now having to do with them. Rebuke them. Aaron had been put to the test when he was left with Hur to deal with the congregation in Moses' absence, and he failed miserably. Basically, he succumbed to the fear of man. So there you see the exasperation of Moses, but I want you to see the excuse of Aaron, because this is what some people see as humorous, but it's really pretty sad. Verses 22 to 24. First of all, Moses makes as an excuse the people's depravity. Look at it in verse 22. Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people that they are set on mischief. They're set on mischief. They're set upon depravity. They're set upon wickedness. So what Aaron says of the people, is it true that they're set on mischief? Absolutely. Does that excuse Aaron? No. But you look at the word mischief, and it seems like an innocuous term to us. Oh, that's just, you know, our kids get into mischief all the time. But that's, it's a stronger word than that. This is depravity. This is wickedness. This is evil. So Aaron excuses himself because of the people's wickedness. And instead of leading them, he follows them. As one person puts this, Aaron, this was Aaron's, not leadership, but his heedership. He heeded the people. He violated Exodus 23:2, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. How obvious even to a child that the perverseness was no apology for the wishy-washiness of their so-called leader. On the other hand, folks, I want you to understand something. People love to put pressure upon a leader who is trying to do right. Do you see that here? People are constantly putting pressure on leaders who are trying to do right. Is there any pressure on President Donald Trump right now? I'm going to tell you something. There's pressure upon every pastor who tries to do what's right. And the pressure is sometimes more intense than you would ever understand. What did this people unto thee? Moses asked, what did they do to you? Moses even recognizes they've done something. What was it that would cause you to do something so egregious? Well, they had manipulated him and he had allowed it. It was the fear of man. A.W. Pink says this, how often we hear the leaders in Christendom saying, quote, we have to make these concessions because the people demand it. We have to. No, you don't. And mom and dad, you don't have to when your kids put pressure on you. The people's depravity. And then we see the exact thing that Pink was talking about, the people's demand in verse 23. For they said unto me, here's their demand, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. Remember, Moses had been gone a mere 40 days, and the people knew exactly where he was. You know what it's like when the parents are gone, possibly, when you get home and you hear the reports from the kids. She did such and such, and he did such and such, and now you hear of all the things. Well, imagine being in a home with eight kids like I grew up, Mike and I. I tell you, I was afraid for my life with my older brother, Delmer. Never Mike, but you know. But I mean, there were times when there was battles taking place. I remember the time that my older brothers, Delmer and Terry, Terry's the missionary to Sri Lanka, and my parents were gone. And Judy, my oldest sister, you know, kind of the matron, and my brothers went into the kitchen, got a big butcher knife, poured ketchup all over it, and went out into the living room. And I forget who had supposedly stabbed whom, but they said, oh no! And Judy came running, and here's this knife, this blood on it, she thought, with ketchup, you know, and she just came freaking out. Those are the kind of things we do. You know, what happens when parents are gone? You know, those things shouldn't happen, folks. But, you know, it's the same. What happens when the pastor's gone? Why is it that the pastor can't take a vacation like everybody else does? And people say, you shouldn't ever leave. Well, if you want to see me burn up, just, yeah. You want to see me die, you know, hey. But that's the problem. Because, and you know why a pastor doesn't want to leave? Because when he's gone, people are like, well, the pastor's not here. I don't need to be here. And it's very disconcerting. It's very, very discouraging. As in verse 1, the people had already forgotten who brought them up. They say it's Moses. And it was Moses. As the Lord himself declares in verse 7. Do you see it in verse 7? The Lord said unto Moses, go get thee down for thy people, which thou broughtest up out of the land of Egypt. We've already covered this. But Moses did so by the hand of God, verse 11. And yet the people attribute it to Moses, verse 1. By the hand of the God they create, verse 4. And when you attribute to man what should be attributed to God, you're involved in idolatry. And when you idolize a man, and that man disappoints you, as that man always will, you will go to another extreme. But in so doing, you'll create your own God. So this is what unbelievers do with Christians. Well, if that's what a Christian is, fill in the blank. But this is what some Christians say about other Christians. You know, if that's what a Christian, if that's what that kind of a Christian, if that's what a fundamentalist does, then I'm not going to be a fundamentalist. You can always find a fundamentalist who's going to do something stupid. You can always find a Christian who's going to do something stupid. And then they go to their own extreme. And so you see here the people's demand. Then you see, lastly, the people's donation, because they're asked to bring some things and people begin to donate. Moses or Aaron says to them, whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me. Here's the donation. And that much is true. That goes along with what it says in verses 2 to 3. The whole record states that he asked them to bring their gold, they bring their gold. But what Aaron said he did with the gold contradicts with what he actually did with the gold. What he said he did in verse 24, so they gave it me and I cast it into the fire and there came out this calf. That's different than what he actually did, because look at verse 4. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. So which is true? Did he actually fasten, or was there this miracle that took place? When he takes this gold and says, watch, and this golden calf comes out. How do you synthesize Aaron's answer in verse 24 with what is recorded in verse 4? Because verse 24 implies some kind of a miracle, as if crediting God for the creation of this idol, because who only can perform a miracle? I thought a long time on this, and commentators do not help. We don't know what happened here. We don't get this, you know. And we don't. How do we know? But here's what I came up with. And it's not something that's another interpretation. It's just the thought. How often men, by using our own creative genius, excuse the resulting sin because of how everything just came together. It was so good. I know it's right because, you know, everything just happened. You can't deny that God was in it because, you know, the thing that I know it's not right, but it just all, everything fell together. Do you know what I'm saying? And how we do the very same thing that Aaron is saying here? We threw it in there and this golden calf came out. Can't deny. Well, that excuses me because I threw the gold in. How was I to know a golden calf was going to come popping out? This is true in the fine arts. That song I wrote, I just felt like I was inspired to write it. How many have ever heard of Bill Gaither? How many have ever heard the song, "The King is Coming"? Totally unscriptural. You listen to the words, it's totally unscriptural. And somebody confronted Bill Gaither about it, said, "How can you write that?" He said, "Well, all I know is God inspired me to write it." See, now God is responsible for an unscriptural song. It's the same thing that Aaron's doing here. I threw the gold in there and out came this calf and it was beautiful. And you listen to that song, "The King is Coming," and you go, wow. And a shiver goes up and down your spine because you don't even know what he's saying. Think about the coincidences of romances. Well, you can't deny that how this happened was he has to be the right one because this happened and this happened. Everything just lined up and, oh, this is a hallmark, you know. And everything just, this was just so beautiful. And it's the coincidences of romances where this was meant to be. And people fool themselves, just like Aaron. Aaron was easily manipulated by the people because he was an exaggerator. Wouldn't you say this is an exaggeration? And anytime somebody's an exaggerator, they're easily manipulated. When Aaron built the altar in verse 5, after making the golden calf, and then he proclaimed a feast to the Lord in association with it, he was leading the people to think that thereby they were worshiping Jehovah. Men still imitate Aaron today. As Bush says, by pleading that the use of paintings, images, and sacrifices is intended merely as a help by sensible media to spiritual worship, written in the 1800s. It's a lifelong problem that this is what we do, folks. You know, what we're doing with our worship is intended to help with worship. Just, you know, to get us excited, to build up the excitement, to build up the emotions, and it gets out of hand. I close tonight with this question. By committing this sin of creating and worshiping the golden calf, which one of the Ten Commandments were they guilty of breaking? Well, you would say, well, the first two, thou shalt have no other gods before me, thou shalt make no graven image. Then let me ask you the second question. Which commandments of the ten did Moses, when he came down from the mount, which did he pull out and throw down? You would say, well, he didn't. He took all ten and threw them down. Folks, and here's why. Because every commandment was broken. You say, how do you know that? Because of what the Bible says in James chapter 2 and verse 10. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of? He's guilty of all of them. And that is the great lesson we've got to learn. You think, well, this one thing is just not that bad. And really, you're guilty of everything. According to James 2:10, you keep the whole law and yet you offend in just one point, you're guilty of all of them. And every unsaved sinner needs to understand that. Because everybody thinks, well, I'm not that bad. Well, have you broken any of the commandments? Well, yeah, just one, but it's not that big a deal. You've broken them all. Moses has taken those and he has thrown them at his feet and pulverized those Ten Commandments like he had to do with the calf, because this is emblematic of what these people were doing. They were breaking all the commandments in so doing. Moses has to confront the people, and then he has to confront Aaron. Why? This is a serious sin. And then we read verses 25 to 29. And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood on the gate of the camp and said, who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him. And he said unto them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword by his side, and go in and out from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay every man his brother, and every man his companion, and every man his neighbor. And the children of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. For Moses had said, consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day. That will bring us to the fourth thing that shows us how serious this sin was. And it's the word separation. It's interesting how that word keeps coming up. It comes up in the morning service. It comes up in Sunday school. It comes up Sunday night. People say, man, you're riding on the separation thing. Actually, I just find it in the Bible everywhere. It's just, you know. And if you would read your Bibles, you would find it there too. How important it is to be separated.